WUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Each week we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, readings by the faculty of the Creative Writing Program from their own work.
Citizenship was a field or discipline in which for certain years I was awarded every marking period a D, meaning poor. Possibly my first political emotion was wishing they would call it conduct or deportment.
Seven university authors share prose and poetry tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The chairman and the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee are expressing concern about North Korea's action in removing UN seals and surveillance cameras from a nuclear reactor. The reactor could be used to produce weapons-grade plutonium, giving North Korea the capability of making several nuclear weapons within a period of months. Committee Chairman Richard Lugar says the U.S. needs to take an active role in addressing the problem.
We cannot take an attitude, I believe, in which we just simply say they are wrong, that is, the North Koreans. We're not going to talk until they do some things right. We're all going to have to talk continuously to South Korea, to North Korea, to Japan, be heavily engaged.
Lugar was interviewed on Fox News Sunday. The ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations panel, Joseph Biden, says North Korea's weapons program presents a greater threat to U.S. security than Iraq's weapons. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's chief science advisor says U.S. criticism of Iraq's weapons declaration is unfounded. NPR's Janet Babin has the story.
Amir Saadi says the U.S. assessment of Iraq's weapons declaration is based on rehashed reports from previous arms inspections. He says earlier tests performed in the U.S. found traces of VX nerve gas on Iraqi missiles, but the tests by French and Swiss labs found no VX. Al-Saadi says the material tested in the U.S. was tampered with.
That VX was intended to manipulate and tamper with the samples taken from Iraq in order to prove that there were traces of VX on them and that it comes from Iraq.
Al-Saadi says Iraq's attempts to produce nerve gas were never successful. Last week, U.S. officials said Iraq's weapons declaration failed to provide a full accounting of chemicals that could be used to produce VX nerve gas. Janet Babin, NPR News, Washington.
Palestinian officials say they're postponing elections that had been scheduled for next month. They cite the ongoing Israeli occupation of major cities in the West Bank as the reason. Israeli Foreign Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the real problem with the election is the legitimacy of Yasser Arafat's leadership.
Legitimacy doesn't merely come from democratically being elected. Legitimacy or illegitimacy comes from actions and policies that are pursued. And in this regard, the words of President Bush are important. He said, leaders compromised by terror cannot be part of a legitimate political process.
Palestinian officials say the election will not be rescheduled until 100 days after an Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. Senator Trent Lott says he fell into a trap set by his political enemies. In his first public comments since stepping down from his GOP leadership post, Lott said that while he has only himself to blame, that there are people in Washington who, in his words, have been trying to nail him for a long time. This is NPR News from Washington.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. Boston Archdiocese fundraisers are hoping donations will increase following Cardinal Bernard Law's resignation over the clergy abuse scandal. Ken Hokanson, the Archdiocese of Boston's head fundraiser, tells the Boston Globe that about $5 million in pledges have been canceled by unhappy donors. The Metropolitan District Commission plans to pass up an offer of free land along the Charles River and instead buy that property, which would protect a members-only yacht club that uses the riverfront. Environmental advocates are criticizing the MDC for protecting the Watertown Yacht Club instead of advancing the MDC's mission of providing affordable recreation to the public. Some independent economic analysts say that the Swift administration's fiscal 2003 budget forecast relies too heavily on capital gains tax revenues that may not materialize. They say the move may leave a budget shortfall of up to $500 million for Governor-elect Mitt Romney. And the Rhode Island Convention Center Authority is donating $600,000 in surplus furniture to benefit needy families in the state. The furniture comes from the Westin Hotel, which is undergoing renovations. More than 300 rooms of furniture will be donated during the next 6 months in Rhode Island. It's 9:05. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Blue Man Group at the Charles Playhouse. Offering gift certificates to the show is a unique holiday gift for all ages. Now available at the Charles Playhouse box office. Information at blueman.com. By the American Textile History Museum, Lowell, now featuring a new exhibit, Reflections, Fashions, Dolls, and the Art of Growing Up. A mother-daughter holiday experience. Information at athm.org. And by the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City, dedicated to making entrepreneurship a common American endeavor, on the web at emkf.org. In the forecast tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the 30s, sunny and brisk tomorrow with highs in the low 40s, partly cloudy tomorrow night, cold with lows in the 20s. Right now, 42 in Boston.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we present readings by the distinguished faculty of the Creative Writing Program of the College of Arts and Sciences, drawn from their own work. We begin with Robert Pinsky, who served as Poet Laureate of the United States from 1997 to 2000, and whose favorite poem project is credited with sparking a nationwide revival of interest in poetry. His translation of Dante's Inferno earned him the Harold Morton Landon Translation Award, as well as the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. He has been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. Professor Pinsky.
It is, again, a pleasure to be here as part of this extraordinary faculty and part of the celebration of the faculty. On the theory that we are amongst friends, I will read to you my two most recent poems. One quite recent. First, I'll read the second youngest. This poem is called Immature Song. Immature Song. I have heard that adolescence is a recent invention, a byproduct of progress, one of capitalism's suspended transitions between one state and another, like refugee camps, internment camps, like the fields of concentration in a campus catalog. Summer camps for teenagers. When I was quite young, my miscomprehension was that concentration camp meant where the scorned were admonished to concentrate, humiliated, forbidden to let the mind wander away. Concentration seemed just the kind of punitive euphemism the adult world would use to coerce, like the word citizenship on the report cards, marked along with disciplines like history, English, mathematics. Citizenship was a field or discipline in which, for certain years, I was awarded every marking period a D, meaning poor. Possibly my first political emotion was wishing they would call it conduct or deportment. The indefinitely suspended transition of the refugee camps must be a poor kind of refuge, subjected to capricious kindnesses and requirements and brutalities, the unchampioned refugees kept between childhood and adulthood, having neither. In the Holy Land, for example, or in Mother Africa. At that same time of my life, when I heard the abbreviation DP for displaced person, I somehow mixed it up with DTs for delirium tremens, both a kind of stumbling marked by a childish nickname. And you, my poem, you are like an adolescent, confused, awkward, self-preoccupied, vaguely rebellious in a way that lacks practical focus, moving without discipline from thing to thing. Do you disrespect authority merely because it speaks so badly? Because it deploys the lethal bromides with a clumsy conviction that offends your delicate senses? But if called on to argue such matters as the refugees, you mumble and stammer. Poor citizen, you get sullen, you sigh, and you look away. The other poem, I am not exaggerating, I have been working on this evening. I don't say that so much to curry your indulgence as to show off. The poem is called Inman Square Incantation. Inman Square Incantation. Forgive us, but we are Americans. We don't exactly believe or disbelieve whatever whoever is president regarding great issues of peace and war. In fact, we tend to be skeptical. But we are distracted by a disjointed swarm of things we try to hold together with no name for the effort. It isn't making a living, though we may pretend it is. The young Romanian poet in L.A., she said shyly, in Romania, a bum is only a bum. You see them on the streets. But here in America, the bums roll steel wagons full of their things. With a mean, elfin look, one of those homeless carters in Alfred Vellucci Park will sometimes beg using a stuffed bear or bunny as a prop. The paper cup panhandled toward the passing marks, puppet-wise. Can you spare a little for Teddy? Or the rabbit's hungry, crooning, wheedling, the mock sweetness and evil parody. Is it the reverse of what looks like feigned malice of nose-ringed kids 10 blocks away in Harvard Square? But the Globe says one from an old Boston family bashed some black girls at a tea stop. Forgive us. We are from Massachusetts. We have no idea that the great American universities are Michigan, California, North Carolina. The plush animal, a sign among signs, his ad for something more personal and abounding than just his freeloader's need. Embarrassment, a sharper pick than pity to block me on my way as I pass under the brazen 10-foot tenor saxophone that marks Riles. Forgive us, bums. Forgive us, homeless, a word we say sheepishly. Derelict is better for these forsaken. Confucian top cleaners, Kashmiri quick food mart, cerveja, vino, licores, improv Boston. Forgive us, necessitous, not derelict, we bustle as though we know the place or don't need to, or hum a few bars and we'll fake it. The Romanesque firehouse's noble brick arches frame bas-reliefs of horse-drawn horse and ladder. Amid images signifying rescue and cleansing, diversion and provender, remember, you rat-faced beggar, I dislike you. Forgive me, and if on the way back from where I'm going, I choose to move a dead president from my breast pocket where I stowed the thing into your cup, it isn't charity, but superstition, a provisional, wishful conspiring with the artist in you. Son of a bitch, bastard.
Poet Robert Pinsky. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Our second reader is novelist and memoirist Suzanne Kazin. She reads from her best-known work, Girl Interrupted.
Christmas in Cambridge. The Harvard students from New York and Oregon had switched places with the Columbia and Reed students from Cambridge. Vacation musical chairs. The brother of my friend who was going to die a violent death, but we didn't know that yet. His death was nearly 2 years in the future. Took me to the movies, where I met my husband-to-be. Our marriage as well was 2 years in the future. We met in front of the Brattle Theater. Les Enfants du Paradis was playing, and in the bright, dry December air, Cambridge seemed a sort of paradise that evening, busy with lights and Christmas shoppers and a fine, dry snow. The snow fell on my future husband's fine, blonde hair. They'd gone to high school together, my doomed friend's brother and he. Now he was home from Reed for Christmas vacation. I sat between them in the balcony where we could smoke. Long before Baptiste Lascarence in the crowd, my future husband had taken my hand in his. He was still holding it when we came out of the theater, and my friend's brother tactfully left us there in the twirling, snowy Cambridge night. He wouldn't let me go. We were infected by the movie, and Cambridge was beautiful that night, full of possibilities and life. We spent the night together in an apartment he borrowed from a friend. He went back to Reed. I went back to selling garlic presses and Madeleine pans. Then the future started closing in on me, and I forgot about him. He didn't forget about me. When he graduated that spring and returned to Cambridge, he tracked me down in the hospital. He was going to Paris for the summer, he said, but he would write to me. He wouldn't forget to write, he said. I paid no attention. He lived in a world with a future, and I did not. When he came back from Paris, things were bad. I didn't want to see him. I told the staff I was too upset. It's impossible, I said. I'm too upset. We talked on the phone instead. He was moving to Ann Arbor. That was fine with me. He didn't like Ann Arbor. 8 months later, he was back, wanting to visit again. Things were not as bad. I had a lot of privileges. We went to movies. We cooked dinner together in his apartment. We watched the body count for the day on the 7 o'clock news. At 11:30, I'd call a taxi and go back to the hospital. Late that summer, my friend's body was found at the bottom of an elevator shaft. It was a hot summer, and his body was partly decomposed. That was where his future ended, in a basement on a hot day. One September night, I got back to the hospital early, before 11. Lisa was sitting with Georgina in our room. I got a marriage proposal tonight, I said. What'd you say? Georgina asked. I got a marriage proposal, I said. The second time I said it, I was more surprised by it. To him, said Georgina. What did you say to him? I said yes, I said. You want to marry him? Lisa asked. Sure, I said. I wasn't completely sure, though. And then what? Said Georgina. What do you mean? What's going to happen then after you're married? I don't know, I said. I haven't thought about it. You better think about it, said Lisa. I tried. I closed my eyes and thought of us in the kitchen, chopping and stirring. I thought of my friend's funeral. I thought of going to movies. Nothing, I said. It's quiet. It's like, I don't know, it's like falling off a cliff. I laughed. I guess my life will just stop when I get married. It didn't. It wasn't quiet either. And in the end, I lost him. I did it on purpose, the way Garance lost Baptiste in the crowd. I needed to be alone, I felt. I wanted to be going on alone to my future. Thank you.
Novelist and memoirist Suzanne Kazin, reading from her work, Girl Interrupted. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to readings by members of the faculty of the university's creative writing program of their own work, and those of people closely associated with the program. Our third reader, poet Jeffrey Hill, is one of the latter group. Professor Hill's English literature courses are often assigned to graduate students in the creative writing program. Professor Hill.
Thank you. We've been told to limit our readings to 8 minutes, which rather scuppers my plans for a happy evening. I'm going to read two or three sections from my most recent book, The Orchards of Zion, This is section 45. Harry Heine and Frank O'Hara, who are mentioned in the poem, are of course poets. "Listen, Meister Eckhart is here, ready and eager to tell us his great news. That we caught aright," the revelatory scream from the carousel, "that there's a divine presence in destitution. That, yes, we loved bright Harry Heine and Frank O'Hara as more than passing attractions when I pass was the catchphrase and they unheard of. That the heavy residues from easy loving render us breathless. Both you and I, who pray with a devot, yet practice every trick in the book, our nuptials are of the spirit entirely. The topos of the whole is gratitude. Duino's cliffhanger we witnessed, and its consummation. Wait, I've not finished. A radical otherness, as it's called, answers to its own voices. That there should be language, rituals, weddings and wedding nights, and tapes which spin fast forward, stop, reverse. That there is even now hawthorn, this bush, pregnant with the wild scent and taint of sex. That there are men and women, destinies interlocked, and dying and resurrection." In section 50, Connie Willis, of course, who is named. Glam Ingmar is Ingmar Bergman. Connie Willis is, I think, streets ahead of any other writer of science fiction on either side of the Atlantic. Covenants, yes. Outcries, yes. Systemic disorders like the names of rock plants, yes. Right side for creativity, yes. And well, if none of us fails our prevision. Re-seventh seal. Prefer bright Connie Willis to glum Ingmar? Pass. The planets of alkali, yes. A methylated cold glow in the northern heavens that spells God the Creator, yes. Who is long-suffering to usward, yes, yes. More sensual, more uncommitted clay our solicited maker must make do with. This means love and fear, soul sister, bounden by deed of gift, by imputation and by adoption, by sighs and groans, aha, to stay and sway us as never before. Oh, never before heard preaching like it, saving your presence, maestro, as it rears spontaneous by the book, the plenitude of the oppressed, oppressive and upgathered. Not condign here to bespeak reprobation, to exhaust Egypt, rise from a dead sea. Keep her going, Lord. The day of jubilo, though not on my program. And finally, a poem which I dedicate to the beautiful young lady who, sometime in 1949, played Viola to my Orsino in the Bromsgrove High School production of Twelfth Night. I had auditioned for Malvolio, and I would have made a superb Malvolio, but they forced me to be Orsino, and I was just about the worst Orsino that you could ever encounter on the stage or off. So when I can find this particular section, I will finish my reading by reading it. Here we are. "I desire so not to deny desire's intransigence. To you I stand answerable. Correction, must once have stood. What's this thing, like a clown's eyebrow brush? Oh, my lady, it is the fool's confession, weeping grease paint, all paint and rhetoric. Empower the muse, I'm tired. Shakespeare, who scarcely brooded on perfection, perfect so many times. Memory, memory. The eye elaborates its tears, but misremembered. Misremembering no less key-clustered mistletoe, the orchard's chatelaine. I may well carry my three engraved thoughts out beyond Shrawley, whose broad verges once throve like spare garden plots with pear and apple, or with wild damson thinner on the ground. O, my lady, this is a fool's profession, and you may be dead, or with Alzheimer's, or happily still adoring a different Duke of Illyria. I have set you up, I confess that, so as not to stint your voice of justice. Love grows in some way closer to withdrawn theology. The deist's orb drops below Anchodyne. Thank you.
University professor and poet Jeffrey Hill. I'm Ted O'Brien, and you're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Our next reader is novelist Ben Cavell.
I'm going to read from a story called Evolution, which is broken into three parts, and I'll be reading from the first part, which is called Sex. On our first date, Heather Gordon orders the Maryland crab cakes with red pepper polenta, and when I walk her home, she asks me to take her to bed. On our second date, she has portobello and endive salad, followed by veal tenderloin with poblano chilies, and we make love on the swing set of an empty playground. On our third date, she tells me she is going to marry me. For our one-month anniversary, Heather lights candles all around my bedroom and strips me naked and walks me to the bathtub, which is filled with warm water and rose petals. After 3 months, she takes me to Paris for the weekend. When we have been dating for 6 months, she asks me to kill her father. The first thing we have to do, Kelly says when I tell him, is cross over. Cross over, I say. Cross over the line between the good people and the bad people. There's a line? Sure, he says. Actually, there are several. We'll cross them in stages. We'll work slowly. We'll keep upping the ante. Did you get this from a book? He shakes his head. No books. This is about personal experience. We must walk the path. The path. The path to emotional detachment. Are you making this up? He shakes his head again. It's in all the latest literature. I stare at him. I thought you said no books. He frowns. From now on, he says. We are sitting on the sofa in our apartment, watching Kelly's high-definition television, which is shaped like a fish tank. The picture is so sharp that it reveals the individual pores in human faces. Kelly says, everything's going cerebral these days. If we want to resist that trend, we have to master the physical world. If we want to be masters of the physical world, we have to know about life and death. Kel, I say, are you sure you want to do this? He looks at me in silence for a while. Then he says, this is what we've been waiting for. You can open a car door without a Slim Jim by bending a hanger into a squared hook and inserting it between the window and the weather stripping and using it to catch the lock rod. Sometimes you can open the door by using a key from the same manufacturer. It is possible to hotwire the car from the inside, but to do this, you need to remove the ignition mechanism and complete the circuit manually. This risks severe electric shock. It also damages the car. It is better to pop the hood and run a wire from the positive side of the battery to the positive side of the coil wire. The coil wire is red. Use a pair of pliers to hold the starter solenoid to the positive battery cable. This fires the engine. To unlock the wheel, insert a screwdriver into the steering column and use it to push the locking pin away from the wheel. We are in a taxi. The driver wears a green knit hat and loafers with no socks. He has a stick of incense burning on the dashboard, which makes the air smell and taste like hot soap. I am sitting in the middle between Kelly and my boss. My boss wears a linen suit. His tan is perfectly even. Looking out the window at skyscrapers like enormous gray wafers, I say, "I don't understand my job." My boss says, "What's to understand? Shouldn't we bring a programmer with us? Didn't I explain this to you last week?" My scalp itches. I say, "It's just that I've been thinking some more about it, and I figure it couldn't hurt to have an expert along." My boss sighs. I look at Kelly. He is shaking his head. My boss says, "Our investors didn't grow up covered with zits." "Excuse me?" I say. "These people made their money the old-fashioned way. They inherited it. And they'll never give it away to some fruitcake in clear-framed glasses who wears his jeans two sizes too small. The key is charm, not knowledge. You were born for this." Kelly is smiling at me. I ignore him. "But what if they ask me?" I lean close to my boss and whisper, "Technical questions. Do they ever?" "They could." He rolls his eyes. "Make something up. We're salesmen, for Christ's sake. What are we selling? We don't make anything." He looks at me. "We make money, kid. I sell experience. Kelly sells cool. You sell cheekbones and green eyes and leading rusher in Ivy League history. Second leading." "My mistake," he says. "It's just," I say, "that I don't know anything about computers." He shakes his head. "This isn't about computers. You think Rockefeller knew anything about oil? You think Carnegie knew anything about steel? All you have to know is what people want and how to tell them they want it from you." "But what if you don't know what people want?" He shrugs. "And you have to know how to tell them what they want." When you die violently, your bowels let go. It's called involuntary sphincter release response, and it means that you spew all the foul waste from inside you, more than you ever imagined possible. Kelly says the next step after crossing over is the planning phase. "Really," he says, "the two steps are simultaneous." I am sitting in our living room listening to the steam heat, and Kelly is telling me that evolution means the extinction of the weak. "Every human and animal characteristic is the result of random genetic mutation." "Yes," I say. "Think of the creatures who lived before certain features developed. Think of the ones whose mutation failed to increase their fitness." I close my eyes and picture ancient sea creatures with squat bodies and tails like embryonic alligators, bobbing on the tide, near powerless with their shrunken fins, watching one of their fellows crawl out of the surf and onto the beach. He will go on to populate the world. The rest will be prey for prehistoric sharks, or else will have descendants who will be less and less suited to the sea and will eventually drown as infants or occasionally flop their way onto the sand. I wonder whether these creatures know that they are the footnotes of history, while their friend on the beach is the ancestor of an entire planet. I think of all the animals not selected for a place on the ark. I think of the thieves crucified next to Jesus. "Eyelids," Kelly says. I open my eyes. "What?" "Eyelids are the result of random genetic mutation." "Yes," I say. "You have to be able to imagine how it felt before eyelids. If you looked at the sky during the day, your retinas would burn. You'd have to walk with your face pressed into the ground, dirt in your mouth all the time. You'd have to sleep with your eyes open." "Yes," I say. Kelly nods. "You need to be able to imagine the time before tear ducts." I am pressing my face into Heather's neck and smelling her perfume and her shampoo and the soap she uses, which is goat's milk and honey and costs $20 a bar. Even through all of that, I can still catch the scent of her skin. Heather is wearing a pair of my boxer shorts and a t-shirt from the gym I go to, which is called Advance. We are watching 2001 on my DVD player. I stop nuzzling Heather's neck and sit back into the sofa with my legs extended in front of me. Heather rests her head on my chest. The light from the television twinkles all around us. "It's less than 2,000 years since the fall of the Roman Empire." "Is that right?" Heather says. "That's right," I say. "Less than 2,000 years after chariot races, we have airplanes and space shuttles and movie theater popcorn." "Amazing." She shifts the position of her body and nestles into my chest. I say, "We weren't even the same species until about 20,000 years ago. Before that, we were Cro-Magnons." "Fascinating," Heather murmurs. Her breathing is becoming deep and slow. "Until recently, we were carrying clubs and living in caves." She is silent. I watch the television. Care Delea has just shut down the supercomputer. This is immediately before the part I don't understand, in which he imagines himself sitting in a room that looks like the smoking room from the world's fanciest mental hospital, and then sees himself as an old man and a fetus. I say, "Kelly and I are making preparations." Heather stirs for a moment and then relaxes back onto me. "Hmm," she says sleepily. "Preparations for what?" "Never mind," I say. "It's all right if you don't want to talk about it."
Novelist Ben Cavell. I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Our next reader is poet Rosanna Warren, director of the University Program on Literary Translation, as well as a professor in the Creative Writing Program. Professor Warren.
This is perhaps an exercise in translation. I've invented a French poet whose name is Anne Vervaine. She was born in 1965 in a village of the south of France. She lived obscurely in Paris, working as a designer for an art publisher, and she was last seen hitchhiking in Uzbekistan in the summer of August 2000. These poems were found in notebooks in her little Paris room by her sister after her disappearance, and I translate them. There's a sequence of five, and I'm going to read numbers 4 and 5. 4. "And if you should answer, I listened years before I knew you to the whine of wind through the high stony pastures above my childhood village. I breathed lavender and thyme and burned my bare legs on nettles, scraped them on thistles, and rubbed the sore skin till it reddened all the more. When we walked the uplands together, you burned your hand and I kissed the crimsoning nettle rash. We are the lords of need, you said, Hafiz said, and I believed you, and we were. In the rugs of your country, carmine is crushed from insects, cochineal, saffron gold is boiled from crocus stamens, and indigo of heaven and fountain pools is soaked hours upon hours from indigo leaves. Like the angel Harut, you said, we are in the calamity of love desire. The angel is chained by neck and knees, head down in the pit of Babel for falling in love. Your carpets told a different story. Scarlet and saffron blush as in paradise, and God reveals himself in wine, flame, tulips, and the light in a mortal eye. All night you held me sleepless on my childhood cot in the stone house. All night the wind seethed through crags and twisted olive trees, high on the scents of thyme and goat droppings. All night, Hafiz sang, I hope the breeze of dawn will cherish the lovers. But the breeze of dawn is the angel of death. You are in your far landscape now. I am in mine. The wind complains, and I can't understand the words. And if you should answer, you 10 years away in a different wind. We are in the calamity, Hafiz sang, but tell the tale of the minstrel and of wine, and leave time alone. Time is a mystery no skill will solve. We should thread words like pearls, you said, and the grateful sky would scatter the Pleiades upon us, though we couldn't see. And that was long ago. Five. The carpet is not a story. It is a place, garden of crisscross pathways, labyrinth, fountain, pool, and stream. As though the fabric had ripped at the vanishing point at the top of the street of ashen facades and slate-sloped roofs, you stepped through the gap out of your own world. I had already lost my world. We met in a torn design, which we tore further, pulling the tall warp, thread wrapped tightly around our fingers until it bit the flesh and the Rue de Lille unraveled. I know about design. It's my job, arranging other people's letters in star charts that phosphoresce in the dark between the closed covers of books. You knew about design from the holes blown through your country. We spoke in a language of no country on earth. You moved slowly in shadow, teaching the shadows to echo my name. You ripped my shirt at the neck. Was it the beloved I held, holding you? Down the middle of the carpet, the river weaves 1,000 gray glimmers into the deeper green. The river knows about mourning. That's its job. How many years has it practiced? With such fleet fingers. A man woke me at dawn this morning, sobbing and cursing in the street, reeling from sidewalk to gutter and back again. On my long gray street, the Rue de Lille, where I still live. Thank you.
Poet Rosanna Warren. We hear now from the man who has directed the creative writing program for the last 20 years, Professor Leslie Epstein. Professor Epstein is primarily a novelist whose work, King of the Jews, has been translated into 13 languages, earning him an international reputation. His novel, Pandemonium, describes the Hollywood of the 40s with humor and originality. Tonight, he shares his latest work, Professor Epstein.
In this story, it's 1952. The boys are about 13 and 14, around in there. And they are being taken by the same servant, Arthur, and his wife, Mary, away from Hollywood in Los Angeles into the desert. The story from which this excerpt is taken is called Desert. They're going to see the Carlsberg Caverns in New Mexico. And because all kinds of hell is breaking out at home, it's thought best to take this trip into the desert and away from home. I can tell you from personal experience that it is not easy to travel with black servants in the southwest of America in 1952. We were probably the only such couple traveling with white kids in the whole state of Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada. And what happened, what happens in this story anyhow, is that they can't find a place to stay, even though they have a reservation in a fancy hotel near the caverns. As soon as the motel owner sees who it is who has driven up in the Buick, they suddenly have no vacancy. So they go up and down the road until late at night looking for a place that will take them. And finally, they come to the Susanna Motel. And this is where I'll begin this excerpt. It doesn't go to the end of the story, but it's a bit of a self-contained short passage. Finally, in Artesia, we found a vacancy at the Susanna Motel. It had just a single building, long and low, with the roof sinking like a broken-down horse. There was only one room for the four of us, and it was at the end, closest to the highway. Barton and I claimed the bed. It was as sway-backed as the roof above us, furthest from the window. Arthur brought in the bags and then went back to the car. He wanted to fill it with gas, he said, and buy some sandwiches to make up for our missed dinner. All we wanted was sleep. In the tiny bathroom, in the green-stained wash basin, Mary scrubbed our faces, which she hadn't done since the start of grade school. She hovered while we brushed our teeth. When we stepped back to the bedroom, Arthur had not returned. We got into pajamas. We got into bed. Mary turned off the unshaded light. She moved to the far side of her bed and sat looking out the window. At midnight, the floodlight went off outside the building. The headlights from the cars and trucks periodically swept across the black glass of the window like a lighthouse beam. Mary made obscure gestures in the darkness. She was removing her clothes. She took off her sweater. She unbuttoned her blouse. Her skirt had a zipper. She stood to unzip it. She was wearing a white slip that, like the bones in a Halloween costume or the image in a fluoroscope, seemed to float and flit all on its own. She moved into the bathroom, then returned to her spot before the window. "Where is that man?" I heard her say under her breath. "Mary, is he lost, do you think?" "My, oh my, I thought sure you were asleep." "No, he's stubborn. He's going to fill that tank or die striving. You go on to sleep, Mr. Richard. Tomorrow we're seeing those caves." I didn't sleep, not yet. I watched the ghost of the undergarment pace, sit, pace once again. Then I watched as, like a smoke puff, it began rising higher and even higher. I realized that Mary was taking off the piece of silk. Something clamped my shoulder, Barton's hand. I could tell he'd stopped breathing. The two of us then stared at her full breast, the bulge of her belly, and the overlapping flesh folds at her waist and her thigh. A car came, followed by another. Her spectacles of gold shone. So did the cross of Jesus at her neck. Her body was like a black candle whose wax had melted. I held my breath, too. I watched as she bent so that her breast hung swaying. Off went her shoes. Then she reached up and spookily took off the top of her head. Behind me, Barty gasped. He trembled, making the whole bed shudder. Then simultaneously we saw that she had removed what we always thought might be her wig. Her teeth came out next into a glass of water. Then she wrapped her old plaid nightdress around her body and lay down on top of her bed. The three of us, I think, fell asleep. When I woke, I thought it was dawn, but the light that poured through the window came from across the roadway. A number of cars had gathered there on the shoulder and beyond, and the headlights crisscrossing lit up the Susanna's facade. I heard music, or at any rate singing, along with shouts and curses and laughter. I rose to an elbow. Barton was already up, clutching his knees. "Shh," he hissed, his fingers to his lips. "It's a lynch mob. I bet they've got Arthur. They started a fire. They're going to burn us down." I sat bolt upright. My heart beat in my ears and in my throat. There was a fire, a bonfire, across the pavement. I could see silhouettes moving in a jumble before it. There were men in boots and cowboy hats. Some of them had burning pieces of wood in their hands. They waved the flaming torches. I heard, beneath the shouts and the song snatches, a steady moan. I knew it was Mary. She wasn't in her bed. She was sitting, dressed and bewigged, in the room's only chair. For a moment, I struggled to work out what was real, this scene, this moment, and what, the image of the maid, naked, taking her head from her shoulders, was the dream. "Where's Arthur?" I asked. "Isn't he back yet?" She didn't answer. She continued to moan. "I told you," said Barty. "They've got him. They've got that nigger. They're going to string him up." I rolled off my side of the bed and moved to the window. I pressed, peering against the glass. I was shocked to see that Barton was right. They did have Arthur. He was standing at the center of a group of men. His coat was off, and each time he took a stumbling step, it dragged behind him in the dust. The men, all white men, laughed and jeered. Then the old servant staggered. He fell to his knees. There was a whoop, a war whoop, like Indians in the movies. I whirled around. "Mary, get the telephone. Call the police." She did not move from the seat of her chair. I ran to the phone. There was a low dial tone, which no matter what numbers I dialed, did not alter its drone. Then I ran to the bathroom. The only window was small and high. I didn't think I could get through. Certainly Mary couldn't. But Barton, by standing on the toilet tank, might just be able to wiggle his way out and try to bring help. Barty! Hey, Barty! He didn't answer. I trotted back to the bedroom. The window was glowing with a reflection of sparks and flame. Not just the window. The door was open, and Barton stood in it, the outline of his body lit up by the fire. Before I could move, he dashed across the sliver of courtyard and onto the lip of the highway. "Let him go!" he shouted. "You bad people! Let him go! He belongs to Barty!" Then, as if the crazed men had heard him, the mob parted, and Arthur lurched onto the black macadam. By one hand, he was still dragging his jacket. In the other, he waved a flaming stick. In the light of that brand, I saw our Buick parked at the other end of the motel. The chauffeur weaved his way across the roadway, shedding sparks. He stopped in front of my brother. He grinned, his teeth a flash of white. Then, so that I could hear the sound from where I stood in the door jamb, he hiccuped, and immediately hiccuped again. "Come in, Arthur," said Barty. The black man dropped the stick and stumbled forward. He braced himself in the frame of the doorway. I could smell his sweat along with the unmistakable fumes of alcohol. Hiccuping still, he stepped inside and dropped onto the bed. Barton followed, closing the door. The celebration continued on the far side of the road. "Look at this fool I went and married," said Mary. "Went to a party, got himself drunk." Thank you.
Professor Leslie Epstein. Our final reader, Derek Walcott, holds the Nobel Prize for Literature. Professor Walcott.
I wrote this some years ago, and unfortunately, it gets more and more prophetic from midsummer. Rest, Christ, from tireless war. See, it's midsummer. But what arose in the throat of the oaks is martial man. The marching hosannas darken the wheat of Russia. The coiled ram hides in the rocks of Afghanistan. Crowned hydrants gush, baptizing the street urchins. The water cannons block their screams in mist. But snow does not melt from the furnace brow of Muhammad or napkins hemorrhaged from the brow of Christ. Along the island, the almonds seethed with anger. The wind that churns these orchards of white surf and whistles dervishes up from the hot sand revolves this globe, this painted O that spins, reciting as it moves tribes, frontiers, dots that are sounds, cities that love their names, while weather vanes still scrape the sky for omens. Though they have different sounds for God or hunger, the opposing alphabets in city squares shout with one voice. Nation takes on nation. And from a fury of mispronunciation, children lie torn on rubble for a noun. Something primal in our spine makes the child swing from the gnarled trapeze of a sea almond branch. I have been comparing the sea almond shapes to the suffering in Van Gogh's orchards, and that too is primal. A bunch of sea grapes hangs over the calm sea. The shadows I shovel with a dry leaf are as warm as ash, as noon jerks towards its rigid inert center. Sunbathers broil on their grid. The shallows they enter are so warm that out in the reef the blear grouper lunges at nothing, teased by self-scaring minnows. Abruptly remembering its job, a breaker glazes the sand that dries fast. For hours, without a heave, the sea suspires through the deep lungs of sponges. In the thatched beach bar, a clock tests its stiff elbow every minute. And outside, an even older iguana climbs hand over claw, as unloved as Quasimodo, into his belfry of shades swaying there. When a cloud darkens, my terror caused it. Lizzie and Anna lie idling on different rafts, their shadows under them. The curled swell has the clarity of lime. In two more days, my daughters will go home. The frame of human happiness is time. The child's swing slackens to a metronome. Happiness sparkles on the sea like soda. Certain things here are quietly American. That chain link fence dividing the absent roars of the beach from the empty ballpark. Its holes muttering the word umpire instead of empire. The gray metal light where an early pelican coasts with its engine off over the pink fire of a sea whose surface is as cold as Maine's. The light warms up the sides of white, eager Cessnas parked at the airstrip under the freckling hills of St. Thomas. The sheds, the brown, functional hangar, are like those of the occupation in the last war. The night left a rank smell under the casuarinas. The villas have fenced off beaches where the natives walk. Illegal immigrants from unlucky islands who envy the smallest polyp its right to work. Here the wetback crab and the mollusk are citizens, and the leaves have green cards. Bulldozers jerk and gouge out a hill, but we all know that the dust is industrial and must be suffered. Soon the sea's corrugations are sheets of zinc salted by the sun's steady acetylene. This drizzle that falls now is American rain, stitching stars in the sand. My own corpuscles are changing as fast. I fear what the migrant envies, the starry pattern they make, the flag on the post office, the quality of the dirt, the fealty changing under my foot.
Professor Derek Walcott reading from his work. Earlier we heard from Robert Pinsky, Susanna Kazin, Jeffrey Hill, Ben Cavell, Rosanna Warren, and Leslie Epstein. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Andy Farnsworth, with help from Keith Infantino and John Hoder. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Van Christo. Join me on Christmas Day at 1 for WBUR's traditional holiday presentation of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, produced by Orson Welles and starring the great Lionel Barrymore as Ebenezer Scrooge.
Christmas.
Don't miss this vintage radio drama classic, Christmas Day at 1, on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
God bless us, everyone.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Dana-Farber Partners Cancer Care, a collaboration among Mass General Hospital, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and Brigham and Women's Hospital, working together to fight adult cancer. Cancercare.harvard.edu. By Surface Works of Watertown and Concord, offering gift certificates for the holidays.